Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In his bestseller, What's the Matter with Kansas?, author Thomas Frank explored how conservatism, the favored political mindset of corporate leaders, and the traditional marker of the privileged became the creed of plain folk. Now Frank tackles another conundrum. Why, if conservatives hate Washington, D.C. so much, they're in rich abundance as lobbyists, consultants, pollsters, strategists, and direct mail specialists. He calls it industry conservatism and argues that if John McCain wins, he will further turn the nation's capital into a place made up of, quote, lobbyists and other angry, righteous profiteers. Thomas Frank, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yikes, right out of the box here. Only Republicans have a lock on graft, corruption, greed.
Oh, no, certainly not, no.
What sets conservatism apart?
Well, the idea in this book is to come up with a corruption theory for our time. There's been a lot of corruption theories over the course of American history, and we're all pretty familiar with this sort of corruption theory that conservatives used to level at liberals back in the day in the 70s. My idea was to explain the current situation, just one scandal after another, the sort of incredible episodes of misgovernance like FEMA after the hurricane in New Orleans, and at the same time also the just rank profiteering that you see in Washington, D.C., the privatizing, the outsourcing, the lobbyists.
Well, let's get into some specifics. Who are the wrecking crew and what's getting wrecked?
The wrecking crew is sort of my funny little jocular name for what you referred to earlier as, a term from the book, industry conservatism. It's conservatism sort of for profit. It's the application of market principles to the running of the state. And what's getting wrecked by all this, and by the way, this is a movement that is hostile to government ideologically and in terms of its actions. There's numerous, them talking about big government and how awful it is, and President Reagan's famous joke about the scariest sentence in the English language being, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help you," all that sort of thing. These are people that are intensely hostile to government and in the course of the last 8 years or so have just thrown many of its bureaucracies completely into reverse, have managed other ones totally into the ground to the point where they're utterly ineffective, like the Consumer Product Safety Commission or something like that, and have managed to put the whole thing on a for-profit basis. And D.C., with the results at D.C., now controlled, or for many years controlled, by this anti-government faction, they've done really, really well. It's a very wealthy city now. I believe it's even wealthier than New York. I'm sorry to tell you that, Amy.
I'm going to have to move. The modern conservative movement you talk about was sparked during the Reagan Revolution. That's where you see the Republican Party not just siding with business interests but becoming a business itself. And the seminal moment for you came when the conservative lobbyist and now convicted felon, Jack Abramoff, became head of the College Republican National Committee in 1981. What was it about that moment and what he did with the CRs that really paved the way for what we're seeing, or what you're seeing today?
Well, I don't think it's like the let me just clarify really quickly. It's not the seminal movement point in the development of conservatism, but it's an amazing – it's a perfect example of what conservatism is about. He got control of the College Republicans along with his friend Grover Norquist, who's a very well-known figure in Washington, D.C. And
architect of the Bush tax cuts.
Yeah, and also of what's known as the K Street Project, which is a fascinating story in its own right. He's a sort of political genius. Anyhow, they got control of the College Republicans and shifted the organization dramatically to the right. There's been, in the course of the 70s and the 80s and going on up to our own time, there's been this sort of string of series of moments when organizations get captured and moved way over to the right, like, for example, the Southern Baptist Church, for example. But that's neither here nor there. What they proceeded to do, they figured out something that's very revealing of the way conservatism worked. They figured out how to do their form of politics and make money at it. How to – and the – writ large, that is what conservatism is all about, doing the politics, making money at it. It's,
so
it's industry, not just a movement.
So it's and how specifically did he do this? I know he started fundraising for the College Republicans himself without relying on money from the National Republican Committee.
Up until he took over, the College Republicans had depended on the larger Republican organization to fund them, and he started doing his own direct mail. By the way, I was able to unearth some of the direct mail from the Abramoff era. You know, raising direct mail at the time. We're talking about the early 80s here. Direct mail was liberals did not really understand direct mail. You know what direct mail is? This is junk mail. This
yes.
is the stuff that comes in the mailbox and has these sort of outrageous claims. You've got to give money now or else something really, really awful is going to happen. You know, those libs are going to give away the Panama Canal or some horrible thing like this.
And you write that most of these direct mail campaigns, the money never really went for these stated causes. They went to
the fundraiser.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating story. And this was fairly well known at the time, but has since been forgotten. And I try to bring the story back because it tells us something very important about conservatism, that when they were doing these direct mail appeals, the people who really profited who got the money was not necessarily the cause. I mean, sometimes they did, but always the fundraiser did well. The fundraiser always made a bundle. And so what happened was a light went on in somebody's head over down there in Northern Virginia, which is the suburbs of D.C. where these people tend to live. A light went on in somebody's head that you could make money with this form of politics. And Abramoff became the head of the College Republicans in 81 and immediately started trying to do this. And then they came up with another scheme, which is even more revealing of the nature of conservatism. They, under the guise of another organization, a different organization, they apparently, according to an old report on them that I managed to unearth in someone's files, they apparently started hiring themselves out to corporate America to do battle on campus with the campus left. Okay, they were going to do this for hire. It's a very interesting thing. This is sort of the birth of a lobbyist here, you know.
So yeah, right. You talk about the fight between the campaign of the College Republicans against Students for a Democratic Society, or no, NYPERG, the PERGs, Ralph Nader's Public Interest Research Groups.
That's right, right. This fighting against SDS was an earlier thing. And then he took it another step further. He started Abramoff started a think tank in Washington, D.C. Very interesting operation. They published a magazine, a bunch of newsletters. You know, they had guest speakers, roundtables, gave out prizes. And it was later revealed that the whole thing was essentially bankrolled by the apartheid government of South Africa.
I'm speaking with Thomas Frank. He's the author of The Wrecking Crew, published by Metropolitan Books. He also has an essay based on the book in Harper's Magazine. And the author of What's the Matter with Kansas. We'll be taking your calls. We can take your calls for Thomas Frank. Any supporters of privatization out there, call and make your case at 646-778-3729. That's 646-SPUD-RAY. Aren't lobbyists – yeah, right, great name. Aren't lobbyists opportunists, though, of the highest sort? What makes you think that this behavior would go away if Democrat Barack Obama – becomes president?
Well, I think just the opposite. It wouldn't go away. There's plenty of Democrats that are just as enthusiastic about this stuff as the Republicans have been. I mean, there's a little bit of cross pressure there because the Democrats, of course, are the ones that talk about the culture of corruption. They're supposed to be the party of the people. But there are leading Democrats that are enthusiastic to be grabbing a hunk of this for themselves. What makes it easier and more direct and more natural for conservative Republicans to be doing it is that they, at the end of the day, they really believe in the market and they really believe that money should rule in politics, that the government should answer to market forces. And so the market expresses itself through the lobbyist or through campaign contributions. And even more, I think astonishingly or horrifyingly or whatever adverb you want to use, and adverbs I try to
You're
stay away from them.
Oh,
but
I thought you were a fan of adverbs.
Go ahead. I'm trying to shake that habit, the adverb habit. But the thing that's really alarming is the sort of turning over of government generally to the private sector, the privatizing and the outsourcing. And this is the signature innovation of the George W. Bush administration. They've turned over all kinds of government work to the private sector. And what you'll see at an agency now, you know, pick your federal agency, and you'll find public employees, federal bureaucrats, sitting there doing their job, and sitting at the table next to them, somebody who's doing, you know, the same work, but is technically employed by a private company, and answers not to we the people, but answers to they the shareholders, or he the boss.
Well, let's take a recent example, this outrage over Iraq's estimated $70 billion in oil profits with little spent on infrastructure while the U.S. is pouring billions into infrastructure.
That just broke today, and I haven't read it. I'm sorry. But Iraq is just
Was that by design, that the United States is pumping billions of dollars into having these private contractors going in and rebuilding the water supply system and the electrical grid?
They're not doing little to finance that. I don't think they screwed it up by design, but they did screw it up. And it was set up as a showplace of privatized government, outsourced government. I mean, there's been some great studies done on the rebuilding of Iraq, and as you know, I mean, it is a colossal disaster. I mean, there's new reports come out every day. It's like, you know, we spent some however many million dollars to have this building built, and let's go out to the site and have a look at that building, and wow, look at that. There's nothing there, just a hole in the ground. What happened to that building? Right. Where'd the money go? We don't know. We sent it to a private contractor. Money's gone. Contractor left the country. Who knows? And there's very little oversight. I mean, you can go down the list. There's hundreds of outrages like this coming out of Iraq. Sometimes, I mean, if you really were given to conspiracy theory, which I am not, you could say that like that whole occupation was just designed, was set up to, you know, funnel money from the taxpayer to these favorite corporations, these corporations that are very well connected with the Republican Party. But I don't go that far, of course. I mean, that would be a dramatic oversimplification, and I'm not encouraging your listeners to believe such a thing. I give the true story in my book, The Wrecking Crew.
Let's take a call. Kobe from Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I'm a big fan of your writing, and I'm also a graduate of the Chicago School District, so well done.
Thank you.
I read the piece in Harper's and thought it was fascinating, and I'll take this offline, but one of the things I'd love you to sort of explain is this idea of free market of ideas, which sounds very, very sort of positive and great. In fact, it's kind of the marketing of thought in a way that benefits big business and not sort of the pure spirited idea that it's kind of. So I'll take that. If you could explain that in greater detail, I'd be very much obliged.
All right.
Thank you, Kobe, for your call.
Yeah, it's a phrase that Abramoff was fond of in his younger days, the free market of ideas. And it sounds, at first, it sounds like a good, you know, very all-American sort of thing. You know, it sounds like the free exchange of ideas, or, you know, the give and take that you see in academia, you know, people arguing back and forth and may the best idea win. But what it seemed to actually mean, in fact, was the free market of ideas, which ideas can be subsidized, which ideas can get the dollars behind them. And, you know, he and his, you know, and as it turned out, well, there's this whole – I mean, Washington is a place of subsidized thought. This is something that you learn when you first go there. You drive down Massachusetts Avenue, one of the big streets, and there's these think tanks, one after the other, of the pretty far to the right, Cato Institute, which is, you know, funded by the Koch family out in Wichita, big oil money, American Enterprise Institute, which is funded by all these different – and, by the way, the American Enterprise Institute, the ones that dreamed up the whole war in Iraq, that was their baby. They thought that up. And that's, of course, funded by all these you know, corporations, the Heritage Foundation with its, you know, very well-known right-wing funders. This is all – it's subsidized thought. And this is what I think Abramoff and his friends meant when they would talk about the free market of ideas, that, you know, the idea that has the most money behind it is the one that wins, not the idea that has the most merit to it.
Let's talk about cynicism. Explain why you think Republican conservatism needs robust public cynicism to make their ideology and agenda work.
And it's a funny thing, because they are encouraging cynicism right now. I mean, this horrible episode of misgovernment and corruption that we're living through. I mean, what is your reaction to it supposed to be? Cynicism. But the funny thing
is, about Ronald Reagan, mourning in America, that optimism?
Oh, well, he did have that sunny side to him, but he was also the the most, you know, the man lived to denounce the federal government and all its works. He regarded it as almost as a form of tyranny, you know, that had to be taken apart brick by brick.
But Republicans have been in control.
Yeah.
At the levers of power for 30, 40 years.
I know.
So
it is so deeply ironic.
That.
I mean, how can you be cynical about government when you yourself have controlled it? And yet they are. Let me take a step back here. The history of public cynicism towards government, insofar as we can measure it, really began with Watergate. Okay. Now you will recall. I mean, this is when public cynicism towards government spiked way up. In the aftermath of Watergate and all those revelations, and it's never really gone away. People have distrusted government ever since then. Funny thing about Watergate, the people who did it were Republicans, some of them very, very, very conservative Republicans. I mean, Nixon loved to have these real right-wingers as his point men on the out there doing the dirty work. Okay, and they caused this massive spike in cynicism towards government. Okay. Now, the immediate reaction to that is it was in 1974. You had this wave of reformers and, you know, very clean politics kind of liberals elected to Congress, okay? That was the short-term response to Watergate. The long-term response is that wave of cynicism that I mentioned earlier that has never gone away and that 6 years later made Ronald Reagan, you know, a possibility and, in fact, got him elected president. And then George W. Bush, all these people, and the Republican Congress of 1994, all these people rode to power on public cynicism towards government, this deep faith that government can never do anything right. And then they get into office and prove it.
So we should dismantle it and give it to corporations which have a better idea
That's
of how
right.
to
well,
run
they,
things.
By their way of viewing things, the market always works. The market never fails. In fact, it's impossible for the market to fail if you read the right economist, you know, and private industry always and in every situation does the job more efficiently and better than government does, which, by the way, has turned out to be false.
Blaise in Bayonne, New Jersey. Welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. My own opinion, this whole era is over. That's what I think we're seeing happening, this Reagan revolution. And, you know, it started with firing the traffic controllers, and that system is still not working, deregulating the airlines and the result that we got from it, a system that's bankrupt. The junk bond era where Drexel, Burnham, and Laird Baer Reagan just sat there and let Wall Street go crazy, defrauding people, destroying pension plans and good companies.
And now we have the Katrina and the bungling of the housing crisis, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Blaise, thank you for that call. Do you think, I mean, if this
is the era coming to an end?
Is the era coming to an end? I mean, he was citing examples that go back
and
several
a bunch
years.
A bunch of those are in the book, by the way, and I encourage him to pick it up because it's, and he's really getting at the heart of the problem there. And is the era over? Well, in some respects, yeah. I mean, you look at the public opinion polls, people are fed up with this.
But they're more fed up with the Democratic Congress than they are
apparently
with President Bush.
But you watch, we're gonna get the Republicans are in real bad shape this time around. They're collapsing as a party all across the country, which is
How do you explain the close poll numbers between
the presidential race is always different. People are always going to, first of all, McCain was the best possible choice they could have made. He's the cleanest. He's the cleanest guy they've got, you know. And, the presidential race is always going to be close regardless of what happens elsewhere. But I want to get to what he was saying about the era being over because the era is not over. One of the phrases that you hear in Washington or that you did hear 2 years ago back when Karl Rove was riding high and Tom DeLay was still running the world, you know, and this sort of thing, was that they were going to have they used to use the phrase permanent majority, that they were going to be in power forever. And I always sort of would laugh when I heard that because it was so ridiculous, the idea, you know, that the D's are never going to come back. That's insane. But I finally figured out what they meant by that. What they meant was that they were going to lock in their model for the state, you know, the marketized state, the entrepreneurial state. They were going to lock that in, build it in structurally so that it could not be undone. Okay, so the things that we're talking about, the private contractors in Iraq, that system is not just going to go away if Obama wins the election. It is going to take a huge amount of work to undo that system. And second of all, think about what they've done to the bureaucracies. I mean, they have hollowed these places out. I mean, the best and the brightest have long since left for the private sector. I mean, it's in their interest. It's almost an obvious choice to do it when they're paying in the private sector, you know, 3-4 times as much money to do the exact same work that the guy used to do for the federal government. How are you going to – you have to basically start at square one. And there's one more thing I want to mention if we have time. Deficits. One of the reasons that conservatives, you know, who always campaign on the promise of a balanced budget and then run up these massive Mongo deficits, you know, unheard of, you know, in human history,
right,
since the Roman Empire or something like that.
President Bill Clinton inherits the
run
up from Reagan.
And what happens? But would you remember what happened when Clinton found that out? There's a very famous story. Clinton had – he got elected in 92, and he had this grand scheme how he was going to do all kinds of great things. We're going to have national health. We're going to have public works. All the – you know, he was going to be like Lyndon Johnson or Franklin Roosevelt all over again. It was going to be great. And a few weeks before he was inaugurated, his economic advisor sat him down and said, look, Bill, it ain't going to happen. Look at the deficit numbers. You don't have anything to spend. You don't have room to run. You can't do it. They've spent the kitty. They blew it on, you know, aircraft carriers or, you know, $600 toilet seats or, you know, gold-plated whatever for Northrop Grumman. You know, I don't know. And Clinton, the reason this is famous is because he had one of his outbursts, you know, his bursts of temper, and he was cursing and all sorts of obscenities. And but sure enough, he wasn't able to do those things because they had driven the economy into massive deficit. Now,
the choice for Democrats who come in on this platform of government is going to help you is actually to
That's
off the table.
Yeah.
So why aren't Democrats following the Republican rule book and just
then they're for balanced budgets?
George Bush got another 4 years. With the coffers being very slight.
He can extend his
legacy.
And
is still arguing to make his tax cuts permanent.
Oh, God. Yeah, they are. And the tax that defunds the state. Look, this is all about defunding the state, making it impossible for liberals to do the things that liberals used to do, okay? And that aspect of it is going to take a really long time to recover from. And they've basically closed off the opportunities for President Obama, if in fact we get a President Obama. He's not going to have room to run.
Tom from Booton, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. I just had a question. It seemed to me when you were talking about the spending of the money and all this that they didn't really steal it, but they were incompetent with it. They're very strange. I mean, I don't understand. They weren't trying to steal it, but they were actually trying to just get rid of it. It's strange to me.
Thanks, Tom, for that call. Help sort this out?
He needs to read the book. That's what I'm going to say. I mean, because it is. Look, the spectacle down there is so bizarre. You know that it makes the head swim.
Can you give me a concrete example that might help sort this out?
Well, let's talk about incompetence first of all, because nobody deliberately puts incompetent people in charge of.
Well, wait a minute. The Department of Justice and the firing of the prosecutors.
Oh, that's right. But that was politicized. What they were doing is they hold politics, they hold a ideology above competence. But you know, nobody's going to actually say, yeah, we put I'm trying to think of the polite word. You know, we put some guys that didn't know what they're doing in charge of everything. But if you – in the book, I came across this really unbelievable example from the 1920s, another era of conservative rule during the Coolidge administration. The president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who are big players on the conservative scene then, still are today. And he said – this is his very famous quote. He said, the best public servant is the worst one. The best public servant is the worst one. Now, what did he mean by that? What he meant was you don't want good people in government. You don't want the best and the brightest. Well, why not? Because that will encourage – if they actually make government work and government functions effectively, people will start to trust government and rely on government. And then next thing you know, slippery slope to communism, you know, right? And I read this and I was like, dang, you know, that's way out there. And then I discovered in the course of my research this – not that exact sentence, you know, the best public servant is the worst one, but that sentiment, that idea, is echoed all down the line, all through history, by members of the conservative movement. They don't want the
good
best
government.
And the brightest in government. They don't want good government. They want politicized government. They want their people in government. But no, they don't want a government that works really well.
Thomas Frank is the author of The Wrecking Crew, published by Metropolitan Books. There's an essay based on the book in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Thomas Frank, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Amy.
And coming up, we talk to WNYC's Bob Henley about the anthrax investigation. Stay with us.